Welcome to the Everesting Podcast, built by Corey. This episode features a very special guest to the Everesting community. It's Mr. Ronan McLaughlin, who is the record holder for the fastest ever Everesting at just a little over 6 hours and 40 minutes, which he completed at Maymore Gap in Ireland in March of 2021. That is one of three Everestings that Ronan has done. And if you've been listening to the podcast lately, we have been talking a little bit, more than a little bit, about the Everesting Rome 10K Challenge and what that is. And I also read out a really great listener email, which detailed the assertion that Everesting Romes would be more popular if some higher profile riders did it. We maybe tightened up some of the rules around what constitutes a fast or interesting Rome route. So Ronan reached out to me and said coincidentally he's been planning a Rome. So I was, of course, jumped on that opportunity to invite him back onto the podcast. And Ronan, as always, was very generous with his time and jumped on with me. So huge thank you to Ronan. This is a cool and interesting conversation, which will be part one, because we're definitely going to have Ronan on after he completes the Rome and he can give us some do's and don'ts from his perspective. And really looking forward to that too. So we're going to wish him luck. We know it's going to be an impressive effort, as it always is, from Ronan McLaughlin. So thank you Ronan, appreciate it. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the State Bicycle Company. You can check them out at statebicycle.com. use code AUDIO23, so the audio and the numbers 23 at checkout. You'll get 23% off your order. They just dropped some carbon frames. Check them out at statebicycle.com. Thank you, everybody, for tuning into the podcast. If you can give us a positive rating or review or subscribe wherever you're finding it, that helps us grow our audience. On to Ronan McLaughlin. I am joined again by Ronan McLaughlin. I don't remember the last time we talked. It doesn't feel like it's been that long, but I guess it maybe has been. But I've got to give some funny background on how this call came to be so quickly. So, but before I do that, I want to back up a little bit, because I think a lot of the people who listen to this podcast probably know who you are or have heard you on the podcast before. But for those who haven't, I think that we should give a quick preamble about why you're significant to the Everesting community. So you're the fastest human being to ever complete an Everesting at 6 hours and 40 minutes, which you did in March of 21. Was it May of 21? Okay.
March of 21, yeah.
Just a crazy time. Correct me if I'm wrong, that's actually the second time you've held the Everesting record, right? You held it for a briefer period prior to that, right?
Yeah, if I back up for a second, I can tell you exactly when we were last on. It was the 27th of November, 2021, because that was the last time I used Skype when I popped onto this call. Your name was the last one there. So sorry, any Skype fans out there, I'm not a big user. But yes, that is, or this currently is the second time I've held the Everesting record. And yeah, it stood for a lot longer than I imagined it ever would have, which is, it's you know, obviously really, really good for me, but also I'm an Everesting fan and I'm a fan of sort of high performance. So I would also like to see riders tackling the record, maybe, you know, going close, maybe not actually breaking it, but, you know, eventually when it does fall, I'm just super excited to see what others can do there also. So,
well, we're pushing two years, right? So you broke it originally. I think you beat Alberto Contador's record, and then you set a time of 7:04, if that sounds about right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I had actually done an Everesting previous to that, and that was sort of the moment of realization, I'm kind of good at this thing. And then about 3 weeks later, I went back to the same climb, picked a shorter segment of it, and then broke Alberto Contador's record. He had the record at that time. It was around about that time in 2020 where the record seemed to be falling every few weeks, and Contador had it at that time. I took, I think it was something like 20 minutes off of his record, and then a few months later Sean Gardner went and took another a good few minutes off my record also. He was the first person to go sub 7 hours. He did 6:59, if I remember correctly.
That's right.
And then I was already planning another attempt at it, but that gave me then the extra bit of motivation to train all through that winter from 2020 into 2021, And yeah, when March rolled around, sort of the first day of decent weather, you know, coming out of an Irish winter that we had, I had a crack at it, and it went pretty well.
Amazing. So that's your journey with it so far. So you completely stripped down the bike. If anybody hasn't seen an awesome video that was produced about the ride, I think you had a 12.24 pound bicycle for it with a fairing on the front. I mean, you left no details unconsidered, including yourself, your weight, the way that you trained for it. You shifted the way that you trained. You were doing really low cadence, high wattage reps to try and simulate the hill that you were using. Like, you really went all in, and it sort of gave you this like a reputation for people thinking, if anybody's going to strip down not only a bicycle but just the whole challenge itself, it's Ronan McLaughlin. So
yeah, so that was kind of part of the attraction for me, was just all the nerdy detail that you could I've said it many times before, it's like the closest thing to track cycling you can get outdoors, and that with it being such a repetitive effort on, for me, in a way, at least, you know, such a short segment, you can actually dial down, you know, pretty much into very, very granular detail exactly how long each lap's going to take, exactly how much effort you can put in, exactly how long it's going to take. And then you can sort of calculate from there, or at least, you know, people with a better mathematical brain than I have can calculate from there exactly how much benefit, you know, different weight saving techniques with a bike, or aero gains, or rolling resistance gains, or drivetrain efficiency gains, whatever it might be, what they actually will turn into in terms of time saved. And again, because it's such a long and challenging event on such tough terrain, the smallest of details end up, you know, multiplying into huge gains. So that, you know, it's a bit like time trialing, and that I love all the prep work for time trialing. The actual time trial itself, I rarely actually enjoy all that much, but that sort of nerdy detail in the build up is, yeah, that's what I'm all about.
Do you still have the bike?
I do, yes. Yes.
As built? Is it just
as built? Yeah.
Like, from that day.
I used it once since for a regional hill climb championships last year. I think I ended up second. I was planning on a sort of attempt at the, or a ride in the national hill climb championships. So ultimately I sort of had a clash with a work commitment and didn't make the national hill climb championships, but the bike was still pretty much as is. The fairing isn't on the front anymore, but it could easily be reattached, yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty specific bike. You're not showing up to a typical group ride with that bike. But you also can't get rid of it. It's too special now, right?
Yeah, I've been very, very tempted a few times to, you know, to put proper drop handlebars on it and proper brake levers and that. But also, I can't quite decide whether I like having it as like a memento of that day, or if it's a waste of a fantastic bike that should be getting used instead of gathering dust. I've been lucky enough that I haven't found myself in the position of needing a bike recently. Maybe someday I just decide that it's too good to be gathering dust and actually start using it again.
Yeah, make a project of it. Well, it would have quite a story if you repurposed it, right?
Yeah, it might taint the story if I ended up coming off it or something and damaging it. That would be the
You could hang it in your office in several carbon pieces. So the reason that I've got you on today is because I just released an episode where I was talking about some really good listener emails that I received regarding the Everesting Rome Challenge, and one in particular really, I thought, very intelligently pointed out that he thought that the reason the Rome had not received the degree of notoriety that a regular, quote unquote, regular Everesting challenge has is because of not having a sort of record associated with it, or really particularly fast times or higher profile riders. And percentage wise, I mean, it's just a tiny percentage of people who in the Hall of Fame have done a Rome of really any variety. And he pointed out something really interesting there, to say, because you have to have two criteria met in both distance and an elevation gain, it really makes it muddy to figure out, like, what is the best effort? Is it who gets the 400 kilometers and 10,000 meters fastest and stops the clock? Or is it who can accumulate the most in the 36 hours? Maybe there's a few different ways to look at it. But he pointed out that he said, hey, if there was high profile riders like Ronan McLaughlin planning Rome's, maybe that would get a lot more attention towards it. So I said exactly what he said in the email in the podcast. And then, so that now I'm speaking to the listeners here. Then I get a message like days later from Ronan saying, I've been thinking about a Rome. So, I mean, if anything was ever fortuitous that we should be chatting, that was it. So maybe it was meant to be. There's obviously a bug in your ear, but so I'd love to hear in your thoughts on like why the Rome hasn't gotten to that same degree. Do you agree with that assertion? And how do you see the Rome? And if you were doing it strictly for time, are you trying to make that 400 kilometers and 10,000 meters sort of align sort of perfectly with at the same time? Or how do you kind of strategize around that? So that's a bunch of questions all at once.
It was funny just listening to the podcast. I think I was heading out for a training spin and popped it on. It was a short sort of update episode, more than a sort of dedicated episode, and I flicked it on and was listening to it, and it was just funny hearing my name come up. That still surprises me. But I had listened to the previous episode you did with Sir Guy Lightspeed, about Rome and the Rome 10K, and listening to that, I was certain that I had sort of mapped out my Rome route previously, around about the same time I was first getting into Everesting and looking to tick off these challenges. And when I went back through my Strava routes, I couldn't find a 10K. So I was like, oh, well, I know I've thought about this before, and I know I have had a rough route in mind, but either I hadn't actually mapped it out, or what for whatever reason, it wasn't there. So I set about mapping it out again. And it was just sort of it was actually coming back to a conversation we had previously where you had sort of inspired me to, take Everesting a little less performance oriented, let's say, and, go out and actually, I think the best way to describe it, actually, if I just back up for a second, is I want to experience an Everesting not from the performance side of it, where it's, you set a challenge, you're training to complete that challenge. But for the vast majority of people, this is, 10, 15, 20, or more than that endeavor to try and complete an Everesting. And I want to get that experience, but I also don't want to get to the point, I'm not going to give up the fitness I have just to ride slower. So I've been looking at ways to try and get that ultra long experience, ticking off an Everesting challenge, but with the same fitness I have. So obviously, the sorts of things you start looking at are like double Everestings or a Rome, or just, I think you had said to me, pick a climb that's never been Everested before and do it there. So you could obviously pick something that's very, very shallow gradient, and it's going to end up taking you 300-400 kilometers, and then that starts to rack up the time also. So I had sort of evaluated all those options, and I think all those options are still on the table. Each one of them intrigues me in a different way, but I think the Rome one has caught my imagination most right now. First of all, off the back of the episode that you did with Sir Guy Lightspeed, but then also just in that it ties in with other sort of goals that I've set myself for this year in the ultra cycling sort of space. And not that a Rome could ever be a training spin, but if you're looking at one of the big goals I have for myself is just to set a mark for how far could I go in 24 hours in terms of distance. And if you're training for something like that, then a Rome over 2 days is definitely a great training weekend on the road to an ultra endurance event like that. But I would also be lying if I didn't admit to, when I started looking into the Rome idea, at least looking up what the fastest time ever for a Rome was.
Yes, I was hoping you were going to say that.
I've got that competitive nature where, I don't know, if I'm going to do it, I may as well at least know if that's within the realms of possibility. And it was kind of, I quickly gave up on trying to find the fastest time because
it's just hard.
Yeah, the Hall of Fame, it's not just as clear cut as it is for the, you know, 8.848 or, you know, the fastest time for a base camp or whatever.
Yeah.
It's the waters are a bit muddier there. So I sort of settled on, you know, mapping out my route. I have one here locally. You know, the first thing my mind went to is, you know, you want to try and get bang on 10,000 meters of elevation gain on, you know, 400.1 kilometers. You know,
that's exactly what I thought. I thought that the ultimate is to have those two things line up almost exactly, right?
I think so. Yeah. Alternatively, and I, you know, not to open a can of worms here, but if you did go into repeats, you could do, I think it would be 84 or 85 laps of the climb that I used for Everesting, which would be 150. These are numbers I'm picking out of the top off the top of my head, but say 150 kilometers, and then ride the remainder on pan flat roads, and that probably would be quicker. But I think it's sort of it's gaming the rules a little bit, isn't it? Like it's not in the true spirit of the Rome 10K.
I would agree. Mm-hmm. And and one of the reasons that I like the idea of Rome expanding and kind of there being some, because the routes are really hard to figure out and plan and have them be practical so that you're not riding 600 or 650,000 or 650 kilometers or something like that. They're really difficult to plan. So if we had people establish these types of routes that we're talking about, whether it's a loop or an out and back, I think those are the two sort of romantic ways that you could do it. That they could be established and other people could ride those routes and there could be FKTs on them and stuff, right?
Yeah, and certainly the route that I want to do locally here, I think I've already mentioned, but I'll say again just in case I haven't, but I've sort of settled on trying to complete a Rome 10K without repeats in one day. So in one ride is the goal that I have set myself. But that what I did end up sort of allowing myself was to not do repeats on a climb, but where I first of all was trying to plot a route that, you know, and didn't involve the same road twice, whether that be, you know, up and down the single stretch of road or whatever. I wanted to complete like a loop. And just with the plotting out those routes, it very quickly got into 650, 700 kilometers. So what I have allowed myself to do is ascend climbs and then turn around the top and come straight back down and move on to another climb. So I'm not doing repeats, but I'm going up and down the one stretch of road. But even the route that I've settled on, I think it's about 460 kilometers. And it's just over 10,000 meters of elevation gain. And I've only got, I think, three different climbs where I've gone to the top of it and come back down again and moved on to the next climb. So I'm going to allow myself to do that. I did, just for interest's sake, start mapping out routes in the Alps, just picking out some famous Tour de France climbs, starting at the bottom of Alpe d'Huez, taking in the Col du Granon, the Galibier, and a few others. And the challenge then actually becomes getting to 400 kilometers without having like 11.5 or 12,000 meters of elevation gain. So very, very different problem. Kind of the opposite, where there's too much climbing in that area if you want to get some of the famous climbs. So that you know, you've got with that route that I mapped out, you know, literally just one loop, and I think that would be perfect for the sort of the FKT idea of doing a Rome, and that the comparing that to the route that I have here, although I'm only, you know, doing those up and downs of three or four climbs, you would probably need someone alongside you just giving you directions, because, you know, I know it in my head. I've trained on these roads for 20 years, but I think I sent you a picture of the route that I was planning. It's, you know, there's so many lefts and rights and ups and downs and through towns, and you know, you're in the same, I think the first 100 kilometers is within 10 kilometers of my house, which sort of gives you an idea of just, you know, how many different changes of direction and that there is. I was just literally trying to get in every steep climb within the area, and then move on to the next area and get on every steep climb, and then move on to the next area. And you know, of course, it had to include Mamor Gap, the climb I did my Everesting on. So I think I've included both sides of that. And then ultimately, I think what I'd done was, you know, divide 10,000 meters by 400 kilometers and sort of work out, you know, what is the ideal amount of climbing per kilometer, and then try to keep as close as to that as I possibly could. So basically what I had done was to take your 10,000 meters of elevation gain that you have to achieve and your distance 400 kilometers and divide the 10,000 by 400 to, you know, that is the absolute best amount of meters gained per kilometer that you can aim for. If you have, you know, any more of either, you're not going to hit either the 10,000 meters or the 400 kilometers. And what that worked out, it was something like, say, 25 meters per kilometer or whatever. And then I was trying to get as close to that as I possibly could with the routes that I was devising. So a few of them worked out at 17, 18, 19, 20 meters per kilometer of 20 meters of elevation per kilometer. Okay. Ultimately, the course that I've landed on, or the route that I've landed on, I think falls into something like 21 meters per kilometer. So that was a way, sort of as a test I developed for assessing whether or not a route was good. Of course, you could just look at the total amount of kilometers you have to ride or the total amount of elevation, but it was just a quick way for me to, even as I was plotting routes, work out, you know, is this road better option than this other road? You know, you can, with Strava Maps, you can plot 2 points along your route. It'll give you the total distance so far and full elevation gain so far, and then you can undo that and plot a different route, and again look at how much elevation gain and how many kilometers you've got to that point, and assess which of those two directions is better when you come to that sort of fork in the road when you're devising your route. So I sort of went into the weeds a bit with it, maybe past a few too many hours trying to plan out a route. I don't think the route that I have ended up settling on is all that favorable for FKTs, as I was saying earlier, but there's certainly, that would be a fascinating direction to take it in, I think.
Well, first of all, I think that the tree branch approach of, you have your main route, but if you can't, you almost feel insane to ride past a ski hill. Right, in summer, you could go up and down and get the mileage, right? So I totally agree. I imagine a Rome route looking very much like that, and it's in the spirit of the name. It's like you're going up and down roads that you see kind of as you go, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that makes a lot of sense. I also think it's almost impossible to do it without that kind of a strategy where you can get 150 meters here and there as you're traveling. But then as you're mapping it out, just from a technical side of things, are you using Google Maps and Strava in conjunction? Like, you're verifying elevations on certain spots?
I mean, like, so I'm not, excuse me. If I was looking at, again, breaking the Everesting world record, then I would probably be going into much greater detail in terms of the exact elevation of each climb. But, you know, again, as this is more of a sort of, you know, the challenge here is completing the Rome, not actually setting the fastest time ever. So I'm less concerned about the exact elevation, with the caveat that I'm probably going to end up with 100 or 200 meters too much anyway. Like, I think the route that I planned out was already well over 10,000 meters, and I think, as you'd mentioned in the podcast, you know, if I got back to my house here and was on 9,990 on the Garmin, I could just do a local climb once and have it completed. So I'm not really too overly focused on, you know, the exact accuracy down to the meter. I'm more just trying to get to that 10,000 as efficiently as I can in terms of kilometers. But I am, you know, for the route that I'm setting locally, I know the road so well. You know, I've been down them all, you know, countless times before, so I don't really need Google Maps that much. But when I just started having fun and plotting routes around the Alps and that, I was certainly using Google Maps and Street View more so to make sure that the roads that I was looking at, you know, they weren't actually just because on Strava the heat map shows up as just routes that people have taken. And what I quickly figured out was that Strava would happily route me up what is actually a ski slope for coming down right. during winter, just because somebody else's heat map had gone that way. So for that reason, I was using Google Maps and Street View just to double check that the roads that I was taking were actually roads and not ski slopes.
Okay. So when are you thinking about doing this?
Well, if you had asked me this when we first messaged over the weekend, I'd have said as soon as possible, as soon as we get a decent day of weather here. Unfortunately, this week I've come down with a bit of a chest infection. So I'm currently unemployed, let's say. So I have quite a bit of time on my hands. And I was so looking forward to spending that time on the bike and doing things like an Everesting and a Rome seem to make perfect sense when you have nothing better to be doing. But I'll maybe give myself a week or two to get back to full fitness, and then hopefully we get a day of decent weather. And then,
so this is imminent.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it definitely is now that I've said that, isn't it?
I guess I'm going to publish this, and you got people are going to be watching your Strava, waiting to see watching this ride.
Probably better just to commit to it and get on with it rather than say, yeah, I might do it sometime. And you know, and you put it on the long finger, the guy that tends to never happen. So,
well, as fans, you know, I hope you set yourself a baseline and start to devise how you can do better. Okay, so what about a bike setup? How marginal gains are you going to go?
You can just
it's a different thing, right? Like, are you more into an endurance road frame for this?
I think, you know, I had been thinking about that, and I'm sort of restricted to the bikes that I have here at the moment. I think so. That'll some way determine which bike I go for, and you know, the difficulty you have is that you've got such a long distance on the bike. You definitely want something that's very much comfort focused. You're going to be out there for so long. That will end up making a significant difference just in terms of, you know, if you're getting riding the lightest bike possible with aero handlebars, and you know, when I say aero handlebars, I mean like the time trial base bar that I used for the last Everesting. That was fine for 7 hours, but up and down one stretch of road, but I don't want to be riding that for I don't know how long, it's going to take 20 hours or whatever. You know, you want as normal and comfortable a bike as possible. But the flip side of that is, you know, if the bike turns out to be 9 kilos instead of 7 kilos, those 2 kilos will actually make a significant difference over, you know, because the routes that I'm plotting, there isn't a single stretch of flat road there. It's either up or it's down. So, you know, weight will make a difference there. I'm not overly hung up on it at the moment because, again, it's February here in Ireland with an Irish winter. I'm going to be wrapped up with so much winter clothing anyway, it's not exactly going to be the most efficient roam ever done. So I think I'll probably I like the idea of going back to my own bike that I used for the first record that I set, the Tarmac SL6 rim brake mechanical group set. I've been riding that a lot recently, and it just puts a smile on my face every time I get on it. That's especially the mechanical group set, that's just such a when you've been electronics fantastic. I love it. I love disc brakes as well. But just that sort of blast from the past almost at this point. It's just a breath of fresh air. So I think I'll definitely turn to that bike, probably with a bar bag and a top tube bag just for snacks and stuff like that to keep me fueled. So it'll, you know, it'll be a nice combination of light, comfortable, and also able to get me through the day in terms of, you know, capacity for carrying all the snacks and food and fuel that I'll need.
Well, I'm super excited to see you try it. Very. How fast do you think you can do it? I kind of have to ask.
Yeah, I might need to come back to you with an answer for that. You can put it in the social media post or whatever for the episode. But I haven't actually worked it out. And then, you know, the again, as I said, the difficulty here is just the weather at the moment. you could get a sunshiny day, but it's blowing a gale, or you could get a nice calm day, but it's raining, and probably for the length of time it's going to take, probably neither is all that conducive to a fast time. So,
right.
I don't know. Let's just say if it's hitting the 20-hour mark, I've severely underestimated what I've got myself in for, and it might not happen. I'll need to be back before dinner time, put it that way.
Okay, man. Okay, get better fast. We're all going to be watching along for this. I'm not alone in saying that I'm excited to see what you can do with this. And you're doing it in February in Ireland, so you can obviously do it fast. Whatever you do, you're going to be able to do it faster in June, July. But it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But hopefully, you get better quick and do it safely. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, well, weather permitting, but you know, now when you mention that, perhaps knowing my personality, perhaps it's better I just wait till a time when I can do it as fast as possible. Because if I do it in February, with weather permitting caveat, am I always going to be wondering, I wonder how fast I could have actually done it?
I assume you will, which means I assume it'll mean two roams, right? This will be your dry run. then we'll see.
I think another everesting might happen before a second roam.
Second roam. Okay. Well, either way, I'm super excited to see what you're up to. So thanks for reaching out. I appreciate it and jumping on the podcast with short notice. And then, of course, I would love to have you back and hear about how it goes and what you would recommend to people who are planning them. The Ronin's do's and don'ts of a roam. I would love to be able to hear that.
Well, hopefully I don't have too many don'ts to share, because that'll mean I've made quite a few mistakes along the way. But thanks for having me on, and thank you for putting out the podcast so regularly as well. It's a great listen every time.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate that coming from you. Thanks a lot. Appreciate you making the time, Ronan. It's good to catch up.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Ronan, and thanks for everybody for tuning into the podcast. We really, really appreciate you doing so. As always, if you're able to give us a positive rating or review on whatever podcast platform you're finding the show, that helps us grow our audience. It's greatly appreciated. Thank you so much. Thanks again for tuning in. Hope you enjoy our coverage of the super interesting Everesting Rome. Obviously, I'm going to have Ronan back on once he has made his formal attempt. So looking forward to bringing you that story and much more on the podcast.